believe that Moses wrote any of the Bible?
Was that?
Do they believe Moses wrote any of
them? I think most of these scholars would argue, at least the earliest ones, that Moses probably didn't write any of it. That Moses was, it was like that Moses was probably this guy who did exist, that he was a great leader, but a lot of myths developed about what he did and what he stood for and that type of thing. But one of the strongest evidences for Moses as the author of the Pentateuch is the unity of the first five books. And the fact that now those who try to hold to some updated version of the documentary hypothesis admit to some hypothetical editor tying all this stuff together, right there they're admitting that there is an underlying unity in the book. And usually an underlying unity is, you know, argues for one author.
What difference does it make? Does it make a big difference?
The whole reason why these guys don't want Moses as the traditional author, and if we go to ancient evidence, the most ancient evidence we're going to find is people saying Moses was the author. So, number one, if we're really going to use just good, unless there's reason to doubt, and then the only reason they have for doubting the oldest testimonies that Moses was the author, for instance, the guys who translated the Septuagint believe Moses was the author, okay, 20 years before Christ. And Josiah's Reform, you go back, what was that, 6-something B.C.? He and his people believed Moses, wrote the first five books of the Bible. I mean, if you agree with the documentary hypothesis, guys, then some of the portions of the first five books of the Bible weren't even written yet. And the portions in Josiah's hands were just hot off the press. Yet equally, this is what Moses wrote, 1,000 years ago. So all the evidence is against it. That's number one. But number two, the only reason why they have to attack Moses as the author, Moses is too great of a personage to call a liar, so they don't want to do that, yet they want to say that these miracles never really happened. So they have a bias against the miracles, so the best way to get around it is Moses didn't really write it. These were exaggerations of what occurred, written hundreds of years later by different guys in different places. And I pointed out, too, that the guys who started this movement, were German thinkers, and it's not a coincidence that Germany was the first, German thinkers were the first thinkers to attack the credibility of the Bible. It's not a coincidence that Germany was the first place for Western society, for paganism to make a big comeback, and for the Germany, the first place where the church in a Western country apostatized, and the first place where paganism made a comeback through what was then called the Nazi Party, and that led to the Holocaust. And now we see that happening throughout Europe and in America today, where the neo-paganism is called the New Age movement, and wherever you see paganism, you are going to see, a devaluing of human life, and the Holocaust is right just around the corner. But also the Pentateuch itself, okay, the first five books of the Bible itself, refers to Moses as the author. Okay? And then the Old Testament refers to Moses as the author, and the New Testament refers to Moses as the author. Even Jesus calls Moses the author. So we got to assume all these other guys were wrong in ancient times when they were closer to the events themselves. they were all wrong, and somehow our modern critics are correct. And, you know, some examples are Joshua chapter 8, verse 31, 1 Kings 2, 3, Daniel 9, 11, Mark chapter 12, verse 26, Luke chapter 20, verse 28, and Romans chapter 10, verse 5. Also, there are many eyewitness details in the Pentateuch, whereas sometimes they have an author writing a particular passage who's hundreds of years removed from the customs that are being explained in detail. The customs are no longer practiced in his day. And sometimes he's giving eyewitness details, geographical details, when this guy's supposed to be in Babylon, when the Jews were in Babylonian captivity. And there's eyewitness details of Mount Sinai or the Sinai Peninsula or Egypt. You know, how's this guy going to have access to these eyewitness details if he's grown up in Babylon, maybe lived a little bit of his life in Judea before the Babylonians took him captive? Whoever the author was, of the first five books, he was acquainted with Egypt and also acquainted with the Sinai, the wilderness. He gives eyewitness details of that, but is very unfamiliar with Canaan. He speaks about Canaan as if it's a place he's heard about, but a place where he's never been. So if we're going to push the authors back past Moses, past the conquest, past David and Solomon, okay, it's going to be a guy who's very much acquainted with Israel, but probably doesn't have much background, much knowledge of the Sinai Peninsula or Egypt. But everything's reversed here. The author is acquainted with Egypt and the wilderness, but is unfamiliar with Canaan, which, you know, Moses fits the billet perfectly there. Also, there's a desert atmosphere and point of view. I mean, you can write a book on this, but just to give you an example, what was the prison system like as the Jews were wandering through the wilderness? There was no. I mean, you either committed a crime and, okay, it's bad enough, you're a threat to society, you're put to death, or you just had to pay somebody back sevenfold, whatever it was. But, I mean, if you got a million people moving through the wilderness, you are not going to keep prisoners. And you find that running throughout. It's a nomadic mindset where, you know, we take no prisoners. And so things are, you know, but it also has the desert atmosphere. You know, you're always building tents. You're not building stable houses. The type of diet is more deals with the desert atmosphere. Also, you have second millennium BC customs. You know, Moses buys a plot of ground to bury his wife, and lo and behold, the whole interaction that he has, now we have documentation, that's the way they did transactions in those days when they sold land. The practice of if a guy dies and he doesn't have a child, his widow would then marry his next oldest brother, and that guy would raise the first son to carry on his brother's name. And, you know, you find many of these ancient customs which were actually being practiced there. You know, how would some author, you know, 1,000 years later know about these? Also, there's a higher percentage of Egyptian words found in the first five books of the Bible than the rest of the Bible. We use like an Italian word piano because it's an Italian word. We didn't translate it, and you know, we didn't just make up our own word for it, and we just took that. And you find that in Daniel, the book of Daniel, he has several Greek words. So they try to push back the date, but all the Greek words are of instruments. So you'll have that. You'll have a few here or there. But that's not what you have in the first five books of the Bible. I mean, you have a large chunk of words, or Egyptian words, because they were coming out of Egypt. And so the ancient Hebrew language of that day incorporated many Hebrew words into it. And then you would find as time goes on, you would start to lose that. And you would still retain a few, which is what you find in the rest of the Bible, but not to the same degree, or the same percentage that you would find in the first five books. Again, Moses is the man. Moses is the guy with the Egyptian training. Moses' qualifications, his education, his knowledge of Egypt and of the Sinai area. You know, Acts 7:22, Stephen talks about a little bit about Moses' background. So Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and mighty in words and deeds. This is before he leaves Egypt, is what he's talking about here. And so Moses was already a very famous guy who had done tremendous things, and it appears that in ancient times that was understood to mean that not only was he well educated in Egypt, but he had already established himself as a war hero, as somewhat of a general who had won many military victories, even before he took on the responsibility of leading Israel. And so, though God, you know, gave him the victories, Moses, as well as Joshua after him, and later on David, was an expert in military strategy. And I mean, you know, Moses fits this. Some unknown guy later on. I mean, when they do this with Jesus, the Jesus seminar, when it comes to the New Testament, and they say Jesus didn't say all those, I am the way, the truth, and the life, no one comes to the Father but through me. You know, all those beautiful sayings that Jesus said, kingdom divided against itself cannot stand, all those beautiful sayings, okay? Well, my question for the Jesus seminar is this, you know, because they reject like 80% of what Jesus said in the New Testament. They reject it as being authentic. My question is, if Jesus didn't say those things, who did? Because whoever he is, he makes Shakespeare look like an ignoramus. He makes Shakespeare sound like Rocky Balboa. Okay? And so, I mean, it's real easy for somebody to say, well, Jesus didn't really say that. Yeah, well, Jesus' sayings have become the most famous sayings of all time, not just because, well, Jesus said it, but because they are the greatest sayings of all time. So to just say that a bunch of different guys just, you know, wrote these things, added them later, who are these guys? These guys are better than Shakespeare. Who are they? You would think that we would know their names. And so... You know, I mean, it makes sense to me that Jesus would say, ask and it shall be given to you, seek and you shall find, knock and the door shall be opened to you. It doesn't make sense to me that a beautiful statement like that would be author unknown over and over again. I mean, it would seem to me like you'd have a combination of a few really profound statements, but a whole lot of, you know, not very eloquent types of sayings, but that's not what you find. You just find profound statement after profound statement, poetic statement after poetic statement, and you know, we're talking the greatest speaker who ever lived. And for people to put those words in his mouth, I don't think anybody qualifies for that job. It's the same thing when you get back to the first five books of the Bible. Moses alone was qualified to be the author of the first five books. Okay, the different names used, the different names of God used for different contexts. When Elohim is mentioned, it speaks about God as the creator. You know, God is the creator and the kind of the God of all mankind. And it speaks of God's power. But when God is called Jehovah or Yahweh, then it speaks about God in covenant relationship with His people, the chosen nation, the nation of Israel. So the different names can be explained by different contexts, not by different authors. And then when you have the compound name, Yahweh Elohim, the Lord God, by giving God that compound title, it's saying, oh yeah, and the Creator God is the one true God who is in covenant with the nation of Israel. You know, it's just saying they're one and the same. The variation in diction and style and vocabulary can be explained in various ways. Different types of literature. Okay, I mean, can you really expect Moses to write in the same, use the same diction, the same vocabulary, same style when he's writing genealogies, as when he's writing biographies, as when he's giving historical accounts? I mean, when he talks about Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, and his 11 brothers, you can expect that to be a lot more detailed than the first 11 chapters of Genesis, which covers all of history until, all of human history until Abraham. You know, he's got to be very general there. So, different types of literature. Also, the good authors vary the text to prevent monotony. I mean, if you're going to call God by the same name over and over again, and if you're going to say the same thing the same way every time you mention it, I mean, you're going to just drive your readers nuts. And so the variety is one of the signs of good authorship, of good writing. And then the parallel accounts is just, you know, poetic, the ancient Hebrew poetic style, which was shared by other Semitic nations. I think you could add a fourth point here. I don't have it written down, but Henry Morris shows that Moses, like Luke, apparently had access, and this was probably kept by the Jews. Abraham probably got his hands on these. There are probably ancient either manuscripts or ancient tablets where ancient genealogies and historical accounts were kept. So, I mean, Adam could have passed on. I mean, we assume no gaps in the genealogies. I think there's good reasons to assume that. Adam could have passed everything on to, I believe it was Noah's father, Lamech. He could have sat down and passed the stuff on to him. So everything could have went from Adam to Lamech, to Noah, to his son Shem, to Abraham. And it could have been oral tradition, it could have been written down, but eventually it would have been probably put down in written form, and Moses could have had access to all these things, so that Genesis is basically his editing. He's the guy that edited and put it all, spelled it out maybe a little bit under divine inspiration of the account of all of ancient history, which God had, saw to it, got into the hands of Abraham, and then from Abraham down to Joseph, and then with the Jews living in Goshen in Egypt, and then Moses takes this all, puts together the book of Genesis, and then from Exodus on, is pretty much Moses until, of course, his death, and then that last portion of Deuteronomy 34, was, you know, where Moses dies, is probably Joshua, probably finished that up, and then began to write the book of Joshua.
With that thought, what if Moses was not necessarily plagiarizing, but copying those documents if they do exist, and it just gives the appearance that there's a style of other writings in there, but only because it is other authors, but Moses did copy from other these documents.
Yeah. He could have referred to the documents, or he could have actually not just referred to them. Don't forget, copyright laws, they're about 100 years old? Even when you read Calvin and Luther, they'll on a regular basis quote authors without even telling you who the authors are. And nobody would say they're plagiarizing. That's just, our laws are stricter today than they used to be. And, but even having said that, nowhere in the book of Genesis does it say, "Thus saith Moses." So basically, Moses is just recording these first five books for his people, the nation of Israel. And just like Mark's gospel is called the Gospel of Mark, and very early in history was it called the Gospel of Mark, though a little earlier than that, when it originally came out, it was called the Gospel of Peter, because everybody knew that Mark got it from Peter. But eventually Mark got a big enough name, so it became the Gospel of Mark, but nobody would say, well, Mark plagiarizes. No. Mark interviewed Peter, or Peter taught him, and eventually Mark wrote it down. And it's not, dishonest in any way to call it the Gospel of Mark. Now, when you write the Gospel of Thomas, and you pretend to be Thomas and you're not, and you're writing 100 years after the fact, and you're trying to deceive people, that's what we call the pseudepigrapha, the false writings. And that's unethical. Whatever the case, I don't really see a problem with he's referring to it. Like Luke referred to documents and all. Now, whether he actually just listed what some of them said, I think in the genealogies, I wouldn't be surprised if he just listed it word for word. Either that or maybe just a list of the names. He had access to not only a list of the names, but how old these guys were when they had their sons and how long they lived to. So it could have been a word for word thing in some areas.
Is there any evidence for these possible writings?
They're actually first you have the kind of like the in the beginning account. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And that takes you through the first the first five chapters, the first four chapters, and then you have, starting at chapter 5 of Genesis, verse 1, this is the book of the genealogy of Adam. In that day, so it says, saying, this is the scroll of the genealogy of Adam. In that day that God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created the male and female. So probably the first four chapters plus chapter 5, which is the genealogy of Adam, may have all been one book. The line of Adam and the story of the creation account that God probably gave probably dictated to Adam the creation account. And then Adam added what happened to him and Eve when they fell in the garden. And then he added the account of Cain and Abel and his birth, the birth of his son Seth, and then started to write the genealogies, and then it was picked up by others after Adam died, at least Lamech. When you chase, Adam was this many years old when he gave birth to his son, and then he lived to be this old, and you put it all together, you could figure out who was alive. Who the contemporaries were, and you find that I believe Adam, Noah's dad Lamech was a young man when Adam was still alive when Adam died, and But whatever the case, then you go further in the book of you probably start at chapter 6. You start having Noah's account, and and so in chapter 10 it says, now this is the genealogy of the sons of Noah. And then it starts giving all their lines. So you have like this other grouping of kind of the Noah account of the story of the flood, but then, you know, given by Noah, but then his sons who treasure that start listing their descendants, and then it comes down to the time of the Tower of Babel and then you would have Abraham in the picture. This is the genealogy of Terah. Terah begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. You know, so but Henry Morris does a real good job of providing a theory where one ends and the other one picks up. And the thing is, you don't have this long line to Moses. I mean, you only got 4 or 5 jumps. And, a lot of it was just keeping the family line. And, I mean, it's unfortunate, but I can only give you the names and a little bit about the lives of my parents and my grandparents on both sides of the family. But if I pass that on to my grandson Nathan, then he will be able to give you the accounts of his grandparents, and at least in my case, my parents and their parents, as well as his dad before me. So I mean, so he can go 5 generations, stuff like that. So with groups like that, especially when you get to, you know, the pre-flood man living to be like over 900 years old, covering a lot of generations there. So, I mean, you got second generation guys alive, still alive when the earth's being flooded. So, the biblical evidence, when you just examine the biblical writings, okay, you see no evidence of the Jewish faith originally being polytheistic or animistic. The biblical evidence shows the Jewish faith was originally monotheistic, but the Jews later became idolatrous, and then there would be like reform movements and all. So, I mean, why just say, well, this is all lies? You know, I mean, it's just like, you know, it's almost like if we can just ignore the Mosaic authorship, then we can just call these guys liars and exaggerators or whatever, and it just, you know, begs the question. Also, the study of ancient religions show that primitive peoples had technical sacrificial language. So even in ancient times, they had technical sacrificial language. So the priestly code, the whole idea that had to come later because nobody had all these technicalities with how they sacrificed animals. Well, now we know that they did. So, you know, the whole reason for coming up with the priestly code is a separate section. Separate author, you know, just doesn't work. Also, you know, they used to argue writing was not invented. No one was writing 1500 B.C. So how could Moses have written during that time? Well, now we have the 1500 B.C. Rosh Shamra literature, so that we know that writing existed in 1500 B.C., but we also have writings that exist even before that. In fact, we have an Egyptian bill of sale dating back to about 3000 B.C. So I mean, it's like, if there was writing in 3000 B.C. just in business transactions, then when it comes down to legal codes and worship rituals and religious rituals and sacrifices, you know, who's to say that can't exist in 1500 BC, when 1500 years earlier than that we already had writing just in business transactions, and we have vast quantities of other literature, ancient literature, that dates back to the time of Moses anyway. So I mean, it's like, well, Moses couldn't have written the Bible because nobody was writing back then. It hadn't been invented yet. So they go and they speculate and all, and now we find out that mankind's been writing even earlier than that. So isn't that a good reason to start thinking, well, maybe Moses did write it then? But no, they just continue to speculate in the opposite direction. Archaeological finds have confirmed the reliability of the Pentateuch. We found the city of Ur, Shechem and Bethel, the Hittite legal code. It used to be argued that, look, the Hittites never existed. This was obviously made up. Then in the late 1800s, they found out, oh, okay, the Hittites did exist. But they did exist, but during the time of Abraham, but they were probably a small tribal people. They weren't this advanced civilization for his day. Well, then we found that, yeah, the Hittite legal code, we found they had this vast legal code. We found out that they were an advanced civilization, a warrior civilization. They were conquering and stuff. And even the use of camels in the Middle East, it was thought that they were not used at the time of Abraham. And now we have Egyptian drawings of camels, and so it's common knowledge that they were used and domesticated at that time. The code of Hammurabi dates back to 1800 BC, and it's very similar to the Mosaic laws. Okay, the book of Numbers, where the Jews are counted twice, one generation is counted, they die out because they lack of faith, they don't go into the promised land, so then they're numbered, another census is taken at the end. It's very similar to the 1800 Mary text of their census lists. If some guy's writing the book of Numbers, some unknown guy centuries later in a different part of the world, how come it sounds so much like the census that list that were given, that were taken approximately the same time as Moses in the same basic area in the Middle East? Deuteronomy, the legal code there, why do you have to invent a different author at different times when you have the same basic format as the Hittite suzerainty treaty? The suzerainty treaty is a treaty between a king and his subjects. Do you accept my laws? Do you agree to obey my laws? Because I will bless you if you obey my laws. I will curse you if you disobey my laws. And now we have the latter half of the second millennium, this Hittite treaty between the king. It was a document. Basically, it was like a document where you fill in the blanks. If there's a new king, he fills his name in there, and then there's new subjects, they fill their names in, and you make this agreement, this pact. And that's exactly, Deuteronomy was actually written in that format, except the king was God, and the people were the nation of Israel. The blessings and the curses of Deuteronomy 28, I mean, you find that straight through it, but I mean, even in outline of Deuteronomy, looks almost exactly like an outline of the Hittite suzerainty treaty. Ancient legends of creation in a worldwide flood are spread throughout the world, and these are possible perversions of the true biblical account. Some would say, well, how do you know that the Bible's the true account? But when you find a worldwide legend, okay, throughout cultures, legends are based on some truth, so hey, maybe there was a creation by God and a worldwide flood. But, when you get to the ancient Babylonian account, the ark is shaped almost like a Coke bottle and it's going to just spin around. Obviously, you're not going to survive that in a worldwide flood. The biblical account, you have the dimensions of the world's largest ship until I believe the 1880s. It was the first time we built a ship larger than Noah's ark, and it has the same dimensions that we build our modern-day barges with. Okay? And barges are designed so that the more cargo they have, the heavier the cargo, the harder it is to topsize one of those. And, you know, was Noah an expert in shipbuilding? Probably not. There wasn't much need for big ships at that time. It was probably just because God's an expert on building ships. You know, he knows what's going to survive a worldwide flood. Henry Morris is showing, he's got his PhD in hydraulic engineering, so, I mean, he deals with water, that even a tidal wave of 90 that would rock a boat, the Ark, to 90 degrees, the Ark would almost immediately right itself, especially if it was weighed down with heavy cargo. So, but, you know, but when you compare that with the boats and the other flood accounts, you know, these things aren't even going to, you know, aren't even going to be able to float across Clear Creek, let alone, you know, survive a worldwide flood. And so they're quite possibly perversions of the true biblical account. In other words, the true biblical account from Noah was passed on from generation to generation, and the true account stayed with, you know, Abraham got his hands on that through the power of God, and then he passed it on to the Jews who went into Egypt, and eventually it was in Moses' hands, whereas other people perverted that account, and eventually when they put it down into writing, it's like, you know, it looks more like a Disney story than a true account. And then also, if the documentary, you know, documentary hypothesis is really hard to believe here, because you've got the Jews, they accepted the law as Mosaic, the five books of Moses as being, with Moses as the author, they accepted the law as Mosaic during Josiah's reform in 621 B.C., okay? It's hard to believe that a large portion of it had just been written. And these guys were so naive that they didn't know that, okay? I mean, if our modern-day experts are right on this, those who hold to, you know, now... But by the way, nobody today holds to the documentary hypothesis. A philosophy professor will talk about it at Olympic College, but no real Old Testament scholars adhere to it today. Now it's kind of like documentary hypothesis, you know, 47th edition, which probably adds 13 or 14 different authors and three or four more new editors. And, you know, Occam's razor comes in handy here. You don't keep multiplying explanations. If one explanation explains the whole thing, you stick with it. And the more complex your response gets, if there's an easy response that explains all the data in question, then there's no reason to reject the easy conclusion. But whatever the case, it's hard to believe that these guys were so, you know, but it's hard to believe the Jews were that gullible that they didn't know. They thought, oh, Moses wrote all of this when a large chunk of it had just been written. Okay? Now, keep in mind, the early proponents of the documentary hypothesis were, you know, they accepted Darwinian thought, hook, line, and sinker. So all human beings were gullible Neanderthals. You know, I'm speaking figuratively here, but they, you know, they were closer to apes than we are. So it just makes sense that the modern man would be so much wiser. By the way, all you have to do to disprove Darwinism there, and to show that our modern man is not much much smarter. See, it's like the philosopher once said. We think that we're smarter than the giants of the past, but it's just because we can see further, because we're dwarfs who stand on the shoulders of giants. So we can see further than they see, but they're greater than us. The guy who invented the wheel is more brilliant than the guy who invented, than Ford, the guy who invented the automobile. Okay? I mean, it took all the entire history of mankind until 1903, the Wright brothers, before we got a heavier-than-air craft in the sky. Then it only took 66 years to land on the moon. Okay? So we think because we landed on the moon, we're the geniuses, and, you know, ancient man was a fool. No, I mean, it took all this brilliance just to get a heavier-than-air craft in the sky. After that, you just combine that with the rocket technology of Goddard, the 1920s, 1930s, you put them together, and we're real close. And it's just, we're just a few mathematical equations from putting man on the moon. And but all you got to do to disprove is just go to Monticello, the house that Jefferson built over there in Virginia. I've been there twice, and I mean, the guy was a genius. I mean, he wasn't even considered a genius. Ben Franklin was a genius. Thomas Jefferson was a slouch next to him. Yet he had 20,000 volumes in his library. He read fluently in 7 different languages, okay? He was an expert at agriculture, great farmer, an expert in architecture. He went in Europe and studied ancient Greek and Roman architecture, plus he took some of the modern stuff of his day and designed the thing himself. He designed his own copy machine, so whenever he wrote a letter through pulleys and stuff, there was an exact duplicate of the letter being written. He had doors that to this day, they have, you don't have to fix them. When you open one door, he's got pulleys under the floor, which opens the other door. So you open this door halfway, the other door right next to it opens halfway. You open it fully, the other door opens fully. You close it, the other door closes. This guy, I mean, he's got gadgets like that throughout his house. He's got a mirror where you look at it and you're upside down. Your reflection is upside down. And and then he's got all stuff from Lewis and Clark from out here, from the expedition of the mammoth's skull and stuff like that. Because he was so scientific in his thinking that he wanted more scientific exploration. So it was like, it's like modern presidents back in NASA and going to the moon and trying to get to Mars someday. He was doing that by sending guys out to a weird place called the Pacific Northwest. And but he was not a genius of his day. Well, you know, you look at today's geniuses, and they don't even come close to that brilliance. Yet Jefferson wasn't even considered a genius. He was just considered a very bright man of his day. So if anything, the evidence seems to indicate that we're devolving, we're not evolving. Whatever the case there, the evidence is overwhelming that Moses did write the first 5 books of the Bible. So next week what we'll do is we'll look at Joshua, the conquest of the Promised Land, the book of Isaiah, because there's the theory that Deutero-Isaiah, that there's 2 authors. The first 39 chapters were written by one author, the last 27 by another author. And it's an attempt to explain away the prophecies fulfilled, the book of Isaiah. And then the book of Daniel, we'll talk about the liberal view there. And so we'll just talk about those 3 books next week, and then we'll move on to the reliability of the New Testament.
Book at Barnes & Noble, right next to yours. I saw another one of yours there. It's a blue one. The guy that's last one before that was No Other God. Mm. And this one book is 100 Myths of the Bible. I thought, okay, I picked it up. And it has it is trying to explain away the story of the Bible, like Goliath wasn't killed by David, it was actually his bodyguard or something like that. Yeah, crazy things like that.
See, and that's the thing is too, is when you get a book like that, it's so obviously written by a pop author. And like when I spoke last week at a large church in Vancouver, Washington, and the guy there was talking about how he knows a guy who has a friend who's a real intellectual type guy. He's an expert on computer technology, but he started reading a couple books and it destroyed his faith in the reliability of the Bible. And so I told him, well, obviously, he's an expert on computer technology. He's not an expert on New Testament scholarship. He's not a New Testament scholar, because if he's a New Testament scholar, he would see that the evidence is pointing in the direction of the reliability of the Bible, not in the other direction. The Jesus Seminar, the scholars that are there are basically ridiculed and laughed at by most of American scholarship and pretty much all of European scholarship.